7 in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics? Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact, supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.
Hello and welcome to The Intelligence on Economist Radio. I'm your host, Jason Palmer. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. A little over a year ago, the global economy was looking pretty healthy. Now, not so much. A slowdown is hitting the world's manufacturing sector and spreading. It's all connected to China's bad economic habits, and measures to stop it might make things worse. And there's a country that's building a wall along much of its border to keep immigrants out. There are fears that the foreigners bring with them a dangerous disease. We take a look at Denmark's pig fence. First up, though. Hostilities flared up between India and Pakistan this week as both countries launched tit-for-tat airstrikes. Yesterday, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan warned of the possible consequences of further clashes between the two nuclear-armed powers. In a televised speech, he asked, "Can we afford any miscalculation?" The conflict burst into life after a terrorist bombing 2 weeks ago that killed 40 Indian troops in the divided territory of Kashmir, the site of many unresolved arguments about territorial control and a focus of religious disputes.
Open warfare broke out in the fair land of Kashmir.
The first war between India and Pakistan began in 1947, just after the British-led partition that divided them. Pakistan was created as a separate, heavily Muslim state. It wanted control of the Muslim-majority area of Kashmir.
Indian armed forces arrived to combat the Muslim troops from Pakistan. In the closing months of 1947, the disturbance turned into a real war.
After more than a year of conflict, Kashmir was split between India and Pakistan, divided by what's called the line of control. But tensions have never really calmed. A major insurgency unfolded in the 1980s and 1990s, with a bloody three-month conflict in 1999. A ceasefire agreed in 2003 has looked weaker in recent years. Protests against the Indian government and high-profile attacks on Indian forces have become more common in Indian-controlled Kashmir. India blames Pakistan for supporting the insurgents. I'm joined by The Economist's defense editor, Shashank Joshi. Shashank, can you just lay out what's happened in the past few days?
Well, following a terrorist attack, India decided, after many years of sitting back, feeling frustrated it couldn't do anything about these repeated terrorist attacks on Kashmir and elsewhere in India, it sent jets into Pakistani airspace for the first time since 1971, a big deal, and bombed what it said was a huge jihadist camp belonging to Jaish-e-Mohammed, the group that conducted the attack a couple of weeks ago, in not just Pakistan, not just Kashmir's part, Pakistan's part of Kashmir, but in Pakistan proper, in the state of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. Pakistan, a day later, hit back, conducting airstrikes on what it said were open ground in India, just to show that it could. And an Indian plane in all of that was downed in the skirmishes that followed, and the Indian pilot is now in Pakistani hands. So we are in a period of huge tension. There's a palpable sense that things could escalate further. And shelling across the line of control, which is the line that divides the Indian bit of Kashmir from the Pakistani bit of Kashmir, has been ramping up over the last couple of days. So things are looking pretty tense.
Well, but it's an area that we know to be tense, has been tense for absolutely decades. Do you think the state of affairs now is more worrying?
I think it is. Even when India and Pakistan fought a full-blown war in 1999 over a little chunk of Kashmir called Kargil, the Indian political leadership did not allow the Indian Air Force to cross the line of control, the border in Kashmir, as I said. They were forbidden from doing so because it was seen as too much of an escalation. So for India to hit back and to have done so deep inside Pakistan, we're looking at somewhere, don't forget, that is about 100 kilometers or so from Islamabad, the capital city. And then for Pakistan to have conducted airstrikes on Indian soil for the first time again since 1971, that is a huge deal.
So in terms of what's likely to happen next, how does the sort of domestic political situation in each country figure in? What sort of pressures are these leaders under?
I think they're under quite different pressures. In Pakistan, Imran Khan, the prime minister and the army chief, which is a very powerful post, they, I think, feel fairly satisfied with the fact that they have struck back, they've evened things up. So I think Pakistan and the Pakistani leadership does not necessarily feel significant pressure to do anything else yet. I think things are different in India. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has an election coming up in a month's time. He has suffered some electoral losses in the last few months. He is not riding as high as he used to. And while his stock was soaring after the initial airstrike, the sense that he's lost a pilot, he's lost a plane, things may not be over yet, there's international pressure on India, that may be a little bit more difficult for him. He may feel that both to appease to his Hindu nationalist base, but also just to make sure he maintains that perception of victory and toughness, he has to have the final punch. He has to land the final blow on Pakistan. So that could sway him and drive him into doing something else still.
Well, there's international pressure on Pakistan as well, right? It's been criticized for tolerating or even supporting jihadist groups for absolutely years, not just by India, but by the international community more widely. Do you see this as something of a reckoning for Pakistan?
Pakistan's had a lot of reckonings. It's not easy to tell if this time's different. Now, Britain, America, and France have moved a proposal at the United Nations to blacklist the leader of Jaish-e-Mohammed, the group whose attack in Kashmir kicked all of this off. But China has always vetoed such proposals. So China, which is a close ally of Pakistan, it's been investing in Pakistan in recent years, that's a huge factor in how much pressure Pakistan will feel or how much it will be insulated. The other big question, of course, is America. America has been squeezing Pakistan as well. Donald Trump agrees that Pakistan has been sponsoring terrorists, but Pakistan is crucial in Afghan peace talks, which are in turn pivotal if Trump wants to take his troops out of the country. So it's not yet clear how far America will go in really forcing Pakistan to choose between keeping jihadist groups on his soil or having a stable international environment.
Well, with all of that in play, then how do you see things playing out from here?
I think it depends on a lot of things. If China blocks the proposal to blacklist the leader at the UN, if the Indian pilot in Pakistani custody, who has been treated well so far, is mistreated or is paraded on TV again, if Modi feels the political environment in India is turning against him, all of that could force him into taking some kind of further action.
And speaking of that international pressure, I mean, is the sort of absence of a strong U.S. Leadership on the global stage playing into this at all?
Right. I mean, I think it is. In past crises, America has always played a central role in trying to calm things down. On this occasion, you know, we've had statements by Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State. We've had conversations with the acting Defense Secretary, Pat Shanahan. But the president himself is distracted. He's in Vietnam, and he doesn't have much diplomatic expertise on this. You know, he doesn't have a permanent ambassador in Pakistan, for example. So all of that, I think, makes it difficult for the U.S. to pay close attention to the crisis in the way that it always would have done, particularly given the shadow of nuclear weapons in the years past.
I mean, it would be good news if we don't have to talk about this very soon again. For now, thanks very much for your time, Shashank.
Thank you, Jason.
Seven in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics?
Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact, supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.
At the beginning of 2018, the world economy was booming. Economists were celebrating the emergence of a broad-based expansion. But fast forward to this year, and the state of the economy is very different. There has been good news. Tensions between China and America have eased after the latest round of trade talks, and the S&P 500, a stock index, has been climbing strongly since Christmas. But the global economic outlook is worsening. This morning, China revealed that its manufacturing sector had sunk to a three-year low. What's happened?
I think when you look around and survey the data, what you see is that a chill has descended on global manufacturing.
Ryan Avent writes Free Exchange, our economics column, and is based in Washington.
The most recent figures we've gotten on industrial production from the U.S. and Europe both show that manufacturing is shrinking in those places. The downturn has also stretched to East Asia, and it's showing up in trade figures also. Export numbers from Korea and Japan, the most recent ones reported, showed a huge decline in exports, and a lot of that is related to a big drop in exporting to China.
Just last year, things were looking pretty good. The economy globally seemed to be booming. What changed?
Well, that's right. If you go back to January of 2018, the IMF was hailing this synchronized global upsurge and said it was the best world economy that we'd seen since the rebound in 2010. But things went south pretty quickly and sort of as the year went on got worse and worse. And, you know, you can point to a few different things happening. One is that central bankers around the world have been kind of worried about inflation and moving to tighten monetary policy. Probably more people have been focused on the trade war, which Donald Trump really began in earnest early last year, putting tariffs on washing machines and solar panels and then steel and then other things as the year went on. That's kind of dominated headlines. But I think actually, if you take a deeper look, what's really been interesting is the weakness in China's economy, not really related to the trade war, but which is having knock-on effects right through the global economy.
And so in that sense, the sort of troubling trends then in global manufacturing point to worries about the global economy more broadly?
So manufacturing ends up being a pretty important sector in terms of shaping the business cycle. People, when they're feeling optimistic, they make big capital investments, build new factories and plants and such. You know, consumers, when they're feeling flush with cash, make big purchases of cars and things like that. And then when they don't feel all that optimistic, they stop. And manufacturing betoken darker times ahead. I don't think it necessarily has to be the case that a manufacturing downturn turns into a broader global recession. But I think the thing that's really worrying is that, you know, most of the steps governments would take to try to prevent that from happening are not going to be as powerful as they would in the past. So the interest rates are very low, so they don't have room to cut them a lot more. Most governments are not particularly keen at the moment on passing a lot of new spending, new stimulus. But I think the worry is that, yes, a downturn in manufacturing could kind of drift and into a broader slump.
So is this just a case of China's economic malaise just kind of spreading through international supply chains?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's right. That's sort of the weakness at the heart of the matter. What China is going through right now is an effort to try to wean itself off growth that is heavily dependent on debt. You know, for the last decade or so, borrowing there has just been extraordinarily high, not necessarily by the government, but by a lot of its firms, a lot of its big state-owned firms. The Chinese government is worried about that. It doesn't want to continue to rely on debt in that way. But every time it tries to tighten up lending, impose more fiscal discipline, the Chinese economy suddenly gets really weak and shaky. And that's something that the Chinese Communist Party just can't allow to happen. And so we keep going through these cycles of weakness that start in China, where, you know, they try to fix the problem. There's a slowdown there that starts to rattle the world economy. And then China's government kind of panics a bit and turns the stimulus taps back on and saves the day temporarily.
But surely a reliance on that kind of mechanism or kind of everyone waiting for that cycle to play out over and over again is kind of a long-run problem for the world now.
It certainly could be a long-run problem for the world economy. I don't think it necessarily has to be. I think what's really worrying is that the times when China is kind of pumping stimulus through the system, it is not also simultaneously undertaking all the reforms that it needs to undertake so that it's not kind of fundamentally weak over the long run. And really what that would mean is taking steps to improve the purchasing power of its consumers. You know, whereas the U.S. economy is heavily dependent on consumers, the Chinese economy is massively dependent on investment. And there's just only so much investment that you need after you've built this massive high-speed rail network, for instance. You just don't need to go back and build another one. And so it's the problem is that the stimulus is not helping the economy through a weak spot, but it's become kind of a permanent crutch.
Is it the case then that the measures China might take could exacerbate the problem?
The measures that China's government is likely to take are things that are probably going to make the long-run problem worse. I mean, you could imagine a form of stimulus that wouldn't, where they sort of just wrote checks and mailed them to Chinese households. That would actually be a good thing, both probably for China and for the world economy. You know, Chinese households don't consume all that much, given their income. And if they were spending more, that would help Europe and the U.S., who would like to sell more things to Chinese consumers. What China's government is probably going to do instead is channel a bunch of new loans to its big businesses, much of which will just be used to kind of roll over unsustainable debts. And then it may also try to juice its property market again, which is not something that it really needs to do given bubble concerns in that sector. So it doesn't have to be the case that the stimulus is going to be bad over the long run, but in practice it is.
Thanks for joining us, Ryan.
Thank you, Jason.
If there's one thing that reliably comes up in the course of reporting economists' stories, it's data. Numbers. So I've been asking our journalists to share some of the numbers they've come across. This time, it's Wendelin von Bredow, our European business and finance correspondent. Wendelin, what number have you got?
The number 3.
3 what? What's that?
Well, that's the number of pigs per person in Denmark. There are 14 million pigs in Denmark, but only 6 million Danes. So it's in some ways an over-pigged country.
So for every Dane, 3 pigs. Okay, but why is this number important to us?
Well, because Denmark is going to great lengths to protect its domestic pigs. And it recently started to build a 5-foot fence on the German-Danish border that's going to be 70 kilometers long, which is causing some concern by locals in Germany.
Well, yes, because Europe is borderless. Why is this fence going up?
It's basically a measure to protect Danish farmers against African swine fever, which is a terrible disease for domestic pigs. And it's a deadly fever that kills nearly all of the pigs it infects. It is no threat to humans, but it's carried by wild boar. So the fence is being built to keep out the wild boar.
Right. Right. The Danes are worried about infectious immigrant pigs.
That's right. The immigrant pigs they are particularly worried about are pigs from Eastern Europe and Belgium, because that's where outbreaks of African swine fever have been reported.
I expect for Denmark, since it's got so many of them, this is not a small boar problem.
No, absolutely not. It's a pig problem. It's a big problem because it could threaten as many as 30,000 jobs and 4 billion euros in pork export. It's vital to the Danish economy, and this explains why they are being so overly cautious.
Okay, I think I follow so far. Is everyone on board with separating the boars from the pigs?
There's controversy from various sides. One is that local Germans are offended by the fence, partly for aesthetic reasons, but partly because they feel it violates the ethos of a borderless Europe. Then there's also the boss of the WWF in Denmark says it's not going to be effective because only proper rules on biosecurity will help, and he doesn't think the fence will keep out the wild boar. There are others, such as the editor of Pig Progress, a gentleman called Vincent Terbeck.
Pig Progress, what's that?
It's a trade magazine. It's surprisingly interesting.
Right. And so what does the editor of this porcine publication think?
He thinks they're being extremely cautious, but it could be helpful. He thinks it is a deterrent, actually.
So On balance, then, do you think this plan will work?
I'm not sure. I mean, it is of some help because it will deter certainly some wild boar from crossing the border. But there are two problems with it. One is that wild boar can swim, and, you know, there are rivers and ponds, and they can very easily and quite quickly swim through them. And then if only one infected wild boar is reported in Denmark, then America, China, and Japan will stop the imports of Danish pork instantly, even if that wild boar hasn't infected any domestic pigs. So the consequences could be quite drastic. So in all, I think, you know, it might be of help, but it's certainly not an absolute guarantee against the outbreak of African swine fever. And I think it's got to do with the government wanting to be seen as doing something to protect its farmers, to help them, and to make them less anxious about African swine fever.
Thanks for your time, Vendelin.
Pleasure, Jason.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. You can subscribe to The Economist at economist.com/radio offer. 12 issues for $12 or £12. See you back here tomorrow.
Seven in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics? Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact, supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.